Good afternoon. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. The Iowa Job Honor Awards, that's the topic of conversation this hour. Launched in 2014, the awards celebrate Iowans who have overcome significant barriers to employment, as well as honoring the employers who hire them. The employees honored over the years include those who have overcome physical, mental disability, criminal convictions, limited English proficiency, homelessness, and long-term unemployment. The Iowa Job Honor Awards is currently accepting nominations for its third annual awards event that will be on June 14th in Sioux City. If you're someone with a disability, mental illness, or criminal conviction that's made it harder for you to find employment, or if you finally found employment that works for you, you can join our conversation by calling us at 866-780-9100. Email us at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org or tweet us at IPR Talk. This hour, I'm joined by the awards director and several of last year's honorees. Kyle Horn is the founder and director of America's Job Honor Awards. Welcome to the program, Kyle.
Thank you very much, Emily.
So why start the Iowa Job Honor Awards? What need did you see that wasn't being met?
Well, a few years ago, I was working as the branch manager for a staffing and recruiting firm in Ames, Manpower. And in that capacity, it really opened up my eyes to the realities of the Iowa workforce. While we saw many applicants who were workforce ready and we put them out to work, we also saw many candidates who, for one reason or another, were struggling to find a meaningful job. And it was always frustrating for me personally to come to the conclusion of those interviews and realize that we had no option but to send the individual on their way, albeit with some references of organizations that may be of help. But I was always haunted by the ones we couldn't help. And as I struggled in my mind to figure out how can we bridge the gap between individuals who are attempting to overcome barriers to employment and the Iowa employers who so desperately need that workforce, that's when I first had the idea for the Job Honor Awards.
Do we have any idea how many in Iowa that are unemployed or, you know, receiving some form of government assistance when they could enter the workforce? Do we have any numbers on that?
You know, it's really difficult to put exact numbers on that, but I can kind of frame it in a way that that reveals the extent of the problem. You know, currently in the state of Iowa, we have unemployment rates at below 4%. So certainly we're in historic low areas. And the number that Iowa Workforce Development typically puts on that in terms of the number of citizens who are counted among the unemployed is probably just below 60,000 right now. So for a good visual, you know, you can picture a full Jack Trice Field up at Iowa State University or a less than full Kinnick Stadium. And that, at least on paper, represents the totality of our active job seekers. But if you look further, there's another number that we discuss far less frequently, and that is Iowa's workforce participation rate. And more than 300,000 working-age adults in the state of Iowa are neither employed nor actively seeking employment. Therefore, they are not included in that 60,000 that I cited earlier. Now, certainly many of those 300,000-plus are unemployed for perfectly legitimate reasons. It may be that they're full-time college students. Perhaps they retired early. Maybe they're rich. It could be that they've opted to remain home and care for family members. Or it may be people whose mental or physical disability renders them unable to work. But logic drives us to conclude that a significant number of that 300,000-plus are actually individuals who have despaired of finding a job. They may be ex-offenders who have encountered door after door that slams shut, and eventually they withdraw from the workforce, dragging their past like a ball and chain. It may be individuals with mental or physical disability who, with modest accommodation, could become self-sufficient, but they've never been able to find the employer willing to provide that. Or it may be immigrants and refugees to our state who are struggling with their limited English proficiency, and perhaps they were highly skilled individuals, even professionals in their home country, but they have a hard time finding a job cleaning hotel rooms here in the United States. So my heart goes out to that portion of the 300,000 who could be in the current Iowa workforce. So you can think of that as another four Kinnick Stadiums. And if we were to bring just one-fourth of that fold into the workforce, then we would more than double our supply of available workers in Iowa. Essentially, we would add a stadium.
Wow. So what about the employers? You know, you've talked with many employers. What are some of the common fears from employers who may be hesitant to hire someone who may need extra care?
Absolutely. You know, and I think the fears are very legitimate, and but they do have answers. And for example, one of the fears associated with hiring ex-offenders is the fear of negligent hiring liability. It's the responsibility of that employer to make sure they are employing individuals who are safe, who will not harm a colleague or a coworker, who will not harm a client. And so certainly they bear the burden of that responsibility, and they don't want to fall short in that burden. And additionally, there are some industries where there are regulatory constraints against hiring individuals with certain convictions. For example, finance industry, banking. If you have an individual with a history of fraud, they would be ill-suited for that position. And indeed, the regulations would prohibit that employer from putting them there. But there are plenty more positions where it's just ill-defined fears that are preventing employers from taking that chance. Now, I've been a hiring manager for much of my life, and I fully subscribe to what I call the hiring manager's axiom, which is the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. However, it's not the full story, because a small percentage of individuals, through hard work, have altered the trajectory of their lives. And those are the ones that we need to pay particular attention to, because if someone has done the hard work to turn it around, they're at that vulnerable stage where they can now enter society, reintegrate, become self-sufficient, and yet still door after door is slammed shut because they're haunted by their past. So in order to overcome that, the employers must be willing to take a second look at that individual and perhaps to reconsider their pre-screen requirements. You know, many of the pre-screen requirements that employers have developed came out of an entirely different context when our unemployment rates were twice their current level. And it may have made more sense then, you know, when we had candidates with pristine backgrounds climbing in the windows. But those days are gone, and employers are struggling mightily to find talent now. So this is the perfect time for employers to get more creative and to consider whether, for example, their ban on felonies makes sense on the production floor. You know, maybe if they look deeper, they'll find individuals like a couple that you'll meet today and realize that, boy, people who have overcome patterns of failure or life challenges frequently make outstanding employees, and they tend not to have a sense of entitlement, but rather one of gratitude, and they have a terrific work ethic. So that's what we're encouraging employers to do, to take that second look.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to introduce a couple former offenders here who were honorees from last year's Iowa Job Honor Awards in just a moment. But Kyle, before we go to them, I want to ask you about Angela Avila. She was also an honoree last year. She was unable to join the show today, but can you tell me about her story? Unlike a criminal background, for instance, mental illness doesn't show up on an application, and Angela suffered from anxiety. She suffers from anxiety.
Indeed, and hers is a great story. We were so pleased to honor her. As you mentioned, she did have a history of mental illness that manifested in anxiety. I think predominantly agoraphobia. Things were going very well in her life in California, and she noted that she was having increasing difficulty driving to work. And eventually, she reached a point where she couldn't make it the full way. She'd have to take an exit ramp and head home. Too much anxiety. And it got worse and worse. And the next thing she knew, she was a virtual prisoner in her own home. And she had a great career lined up before the onset, and that career was lost. Ultimately, she came out to Iowa, where she has some family. And through counseling and through a very accepting and warm community, she began to overcome that anxiety. And while it's true that that would not be listed on a job application or on a resume, it did haunt her in terms of the notable gap in employment. And, of course, employers saw she wasn't working. They asked. And of course, she was compelled to answer honestly. And so it turned some employers off. But fortunately, she found in the Creston, Iowa Workforce Development Office a fantastic team that was willing to have the patience to work with her and find an employer that was willing to look beyond her problems of the past and to recognize that she was on the road to recovery. And through an internship, she landed a job with a farm supply store there and worked there for about a year. And when I chatted with her recently, she was able to move on to another opportunity that was a little more suited to her life right now. Frankly, it represented a pay increase. So she's on her way up. And what it required was the individuals willing to work with her, the job developers, providers like the Iowa Works folks, and an employer who was willing to take a chance. And it turned into a success story for Angela. We're all very proud of her.
I'm talking with the founder and director of the Iowa Job Honor Awards. It's an award meant to rekindle hope and energize the work ethic across the nation through the celebration of people who have overcome barriers to employment and employers who reach out to those who otherwise might be looked over for a job. Kyle, briefly, the nomination process is still open for this year. Nominations are due by April 15th. Who should apply and why? How should they go about
playing? Absolutely. To apply, please visit our website at www.jobhonor.org. And right there on the homepage, we have a button that says nominations for Iowa are open. And so they can click on that button, and that will take them to forms from one of two categories. And the first category is individuals who have overcome significant barriers to employment. The second category is employers that do a laudable job of hiring those individuals. And frequently we see that our nominees arise from the human services arena. Job developers who have worked with candidates have seen some remarkable turnarounds, and they want to share those stories. Although we've also received some great nominations from employers, and we welcome self-nominations as well. And so anywhere there's a wonderful story of having faced barriers to employment and found the appropriate tools to overcome them and then landed a job and turned it around, those stories are needed to inspire others who are struggling in similar circumstances and also to open the eyes of employers that the past is not the only predictor of the future. People can indeed turn it around, and they do every day.
I'd like to bring Edward Ailey Roberson into the conversation. He's a former Marine and former offender, now living in Des Moines, working for Manco Window Systems. Hi, Edward, and congratulations on the award.
Hi, Emily. Thank you very much.
So you received this award last year. You're doing very well at your job, recently married, I hear, but things weren't always so stable for you. You've struggled with substance abuse, went to prison, came out of prison, lived at a homeless shelter before getting to where you are today. Take us back to the beginning. How did things start to slide downward for you?
Well, I suffered from very bad choices and grief decisions. My father was murdered a while back, immediately after I got out of the military. It made me feel like, okay, I can defend my country, but I can't defend my family. I turned to drinking and drugs almost right away. A little later in life, after one divorce, I had a sister murdered. And I made another bad decision on the grief issue, turning to drugs and alcohol for my remedy. But along with that, I got into a fight and, a guy was killed. And I was in a blackout drunk at the time. And when I came out of that drunk, I immediately went to God. And, that sounds kind of cliche for someone who's locked up or going to be locked up for a while. But it's the truth. And, the 7 months I spent in county jail, I turned to all sorts of religious and spiritual advice and knowledge from the Bible. After getting into prison, I had an opportunity to do something that I thought was more discipline and spirituality, and it was Islam. I studied Islam, the Quran, 8 hours a day. I pumped iron, and right away I began to recondition my mind to say things as whatever's detrimental to Edward and Edward's lifestyle, and especially Edward's freedom. Dive, roll, run, get out of the way. Leave that alone. Upon entering the shelter, CISS shelter here in Des Moines, and it is a wet shelter, and I realized that right off the bat.
Wet meaning that you can come in after drinking alcohol, for instance.
Yes. Yeah. I feel that as long as you act appropriately, if you've been doing methamphetamine, smoking pot, drinking whatever, that they will allow you in, which is okay. It's one of those things I have to learn to be flexible with. Also in prison, I learned to do that, to be flexible and not so rigid, about the standards that I set for myself on someone else. you know, knowing that, I really had to be careful. And it's also a great proving ground for an individual. You know, I stayed away from that. You know, I prayed. You know, I counseled with people. Terry Thomas, she was my veterans counselor. She got me right back and active with the VA. You know, I got therapy. I also suffer from bipolar disorder. So there's anxiety and depression on both ends. And even with that, you know, I kept my spiritual foundation and I began to make small attainable goals. And as I attained each goal, I felt stronger, more confident, more flexible, more everything, positive.
Mm-hmm. And now you're doing really well working for Manco Windows. Tell me about that.
Well, I was one of those guys that being a felon and African-American and bipolar and all the other isms, I was afraid to even apply for a job. I was afraid to even mark that little box in, I'm a felon, and they try to explain. I would always put, okay, we'll explain during an interview if allowed, you know, because I didn't want anybody to know, you know, right off the bat what I did, because I knew they'd throw my application either in the trash or at the bottom of the pile. Along with that, I came out with the determination and the motivation of a Marine, and that all I really wanted was some type of objective to achieve. That was my heart set. So I was afraid. You know, I didn't want to fill out those applications, but I did. And I got turned down a few times. Terry Thomas guided me toward Danny Sims, which is a vocational rehab specialist for the Veterans Administration. And he told me, you know, it's going to be hard for you, da-da-da. You know, these things are going to happen. You might get turned down, but just don't stop trying. I told him I wouldn't. So he knew people that, I guess, knew people that knew people that knew people. So he knew the guys at Manco. The first interview, I walked in, I met Kevin Bauer at that time, who was the manager. You know, he asked me, he said, Edward, you know, what happened? So I told him the story. And after that, he said, well, what do you want to do? I said, really, all I want to do is go to work. Whatever you want me to do, I can do, because I had that type of flexibility and motivation. Mm-hmm. So he hired me, and that, you know, it was, you know, I came to work. I came to work on time. Matter of fact, I came to work early. I stayed late. Whatever he wanted me to do, I didn't have any problem with it. I'd say, yes, sir. And being a former Marine and a former soldier, the objective part is I drive. So I didn't have to have someone micromanaging me. You know, those type things. I would just get the job done, and I'd come back and say, do you like it? He's happy. Mm-hmm. So he would give me more and more, and that's how I developed.
John Romeo, I want to bring you into the conversation. We're talking about the Iowa Job Honor Awards this hour. Workforce Solutions of Burlington was honored for their commitment to hire disadvantaged candidates such as yourself. You were incarcerated for 22 years from 1990 to 2011, and you're now a workforce development specialist, and you're teaching a course at Southwestern Community College called New Beginnings. You know, Edward talked a little bit about recidivism, about, you know, when offenders are released, going back into that kind of crime versus, you know, the struggle to find a job. And can you speak a little bit about that? What was your struggle to find a job like after you were released? And, you know, do you see that in a lot of your students that you teach today?
I think Mr. Roberson addressed that issue very well. I would like to tell you that when I'm an offender workforce development specialist at Southeastern Community College. And the biggest thing I see as people transition away from corrections is that when they transition, they don't understand that transitioning away from corrections is an emotional journey. It's not just get a job and meet requirements and pay rent. It's an emotional journey. And so the class I teach focuses on transitioning offenders, their motivations, their values, their critical thinking, and their empathy. And the whole class is taught from a perspective of someone who's already been in their shoes, has a great understanding of where they've come from, and with a goal of getting them where they want to be. When they have this conversation, we talk about motivations and values prior to offense, currently as they transition, and into the future. And that's the big point with New Beginnings. The last caveat of New Beginnings is when I'm talking to the gentlemen in the class, and sometimes the women as they transition as well, is that when I'm teaching the class, they have no idea of my past. And I don't announce that early. I don't announce that hardly at all. But every now and then, one or two find out, and they ask me. And I said, isn't it great that I knew you? I was with you for over 2 weeks and you never had a single idea? And that, I tell them, is the goal. that people should not be able to label you or mark you by the way you act, the way you behave, who you associate with. And so the big selling point of this program is to transition away from corrections by understanding where you were with your values and motivations and critical thinking, empathy, and to create a roadmap of where you're going through the same tools.
Mm-hmm. Very briefly, we're quickly running out of time, but John, what would you say to people who are listening right now who may be just out of prison struggling to find work? Do you have any advice for them?
It's difficult, and it's going to take perseverance and patience. Working with the right tools and the right people, you can succeed. It's not going to be easy. I want to make sure that people know that going to corrections is not a winning a lottery choice. It's a bad creation of bad choices. But through better choices, better opportunities are created.
I'd like to bring in Clay Haley before we end this hour. He's another Iowa Job Honor Awards recipient. He's the president of Haley Equipment. Hi, Clay.
Hello.
So you've made a point to hire those who might otherwise have trouble finding work. Who have you hired, and what made you make the decision to hire them over someone else?
You know, we look at the individual is what we tend to do, rather than looking at past offenses, past transgressions. We've all had things that we've done that we've regretted, and each of us deserves a chance to move forward. So I've worked with numerous people across the years and had the privilege to work with them who have had different challenges, be it substance abuse, hearing impairment, just several different folks across the years. And if you drill down to the core of the person and you take a little bit of time to help nurture them, they can make better employees than other people.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've quickly run out of time this hour. This has been a fascinating discussion. I want to thank all my guests, Kyle Horn, the director of America's Job Honor Awards, Edward Ailey Roberson, John Romeo, and Clay Haley, president of Haley Equipment. Thanks to you all. And Edward, John, and Clay, congratulations on receiving an Iowa Job Honor Award. We're going to take a short break. You're going to want to stay with us. Coming up in just a few minutes, a listen back to Ben Kiefer's conversation with Matan Koch. He's a disability rights attorney who advocates for more inclusive workplaces and increased employment of those with disabilities. This is something Koch himself has struggled with as someone with cerebral palsy. Stay with us. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on the show, it's Politics Day. Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa will join the show to talk about the results of the Super Tuesday primary election. Will Donald Trump sweep all 12 of the Super Tuesday states? Tune in tomorrow for the discussion. In this half hour, we're listening back to a conversation Ben Kiefer had with Matan Koch from March of last year.
Today, exploring a couple of different perspectives on disabilities and disabilities in the workplace. My next guest is Matan Koch. He learned at a very early age that the key to succeeding with his disability was to focus on the many abilities with which he was blessed rather than focusing on those things he was unable to do. Now he's a prominent disability rights lawyer. He's spent his life working to maximize the value of people with disabilities. He's also a presidential appointee to the National Council on Disability. Matan Koch, welcome to our program.
Thank you. So glad to be here.
You were born with cerebral palsy. That's a movement disorder. Tell us, if you could, about your first awareness of your disability and your awareness that you were different.
Well, it's interesting. I think that my first awareness that when I was different was when I actually had to articulate it. I was about 4 years old, and my parents, who were both Jewish professionals, were working at a summer camp, and I was asked to address the camp on, I think, what we then probably referred to as handicap, right? Disability probably wasn't even the word back then, and to talk about what life was like. And honestly, for the life of me, I couldn't understand the nature of the question. I mean, I knew that I was in a wheelchair. I wasn't, you know, blind to my own situation, and but I what I didn't know was why that was something worth talking about. And so while my parents were explaining that to me, I hit on the way that I'd always been raised to understand things, that we have things that we do well, that we have things that we do not so well, that at the time, you know, I couldn't move so well, and I had a brother who didn't speak so well, and we had our different strengths and our different weaknesses. And so when I said that to my folks, they said, so talk about that. And so I got up and I spoke to a group of a couple of hundred children in Massachusetts and said, everyone has a disability. And the way that I understood disability, which is to be some things that they don't do as well as other folks do it. And I think that guiding philosophy, you know, 30 years later still drives what it is that I do.
So that was really the origins of thinking about disabilities differently and a way to think about disability that you wish that the entire society thought about it.
Yes. I mean, I think that as a general rule, we gain so much more when we focus on people's positives, right? Nobody ever says, you know, I want someone with me because of this thing that we've identified as a problem. You say, well, they'd be a great friend. They'd be a great colleague. They'd be a great contributor to my business. And, you know, I want to meet them where they are and do what has to be done that they're able to contribute here. They're welcome here, whether the obstacle that they're facing is an identified disability or just something else that they need to meet. It could be a difficult commute. It could be childcare responsibilities. I basically think that if we can rearrange the paradigm that says we focus on the fact that we want people's talents, we want people's strengths, we want the things we value about each other, and we're going to do what we have to do to get them to us, the significance of those things that we've chosen to label disabilities changes.
Mm. Tell me on a personal level, when you meet someone who you haven't met before, how do you break through so that the person who has perhaps never had a friend or a colleague with cerebral palsy in this case, that you can break through and connect with them as a human to human rather than them seeing only the disorder that is apparent to them?
I think what I do is, not to sound simplistic, but I simply interact with them as I was already planning to. For many of them, hopefully who I am makes the impression, and whatever preconception they walked in with begins to fall away. For some, I'm going to miss that mark, and they're going to be really focused on the chair that I'm sitting in and not what I have to do. I think one of the big things that I had to realize was that my only responsibility and really the only thing that I can do is to fully be the person that I am and hope that they appreciate it. I can't take it upon myself to specifically break through any wall they might have, because then, believe it or not, I've made my disability just as central as they are, right? If I've focused my effort on breaking their conception, then I've made disability the center part of the discussion. And if I focus on what I bring to the table, you know, it's up to them to say, wow, he's such a good lawyer. Oh, yeah, by the way, he's in a wheelchair. Or,
right.
Wow, those stories he tells. But he's in a wheelchair.
Do you see, though, that if the disability is preventing some communication or is a distraction, do you just address it head on to get it out of the way?
Well, if it's very clear that they're focused, then I might address it head on. I mean, usually with adults, to be honest, it's harder to tell. But what I love is kids. I love kids who walk up and they're clearly just curious because I look a little different, the chair's a little different, and my hope is that they will be encouraged to ask questions. I love to discuss with them frankly what I am and what's different, because kids learn by experiencing the different and making it the same. And the honest answer is, yes, I would love to do the same thing with adults. As a practical matter, you won't often have that opportunity because most adults have been socialized that I'd really be guessing if I wanted to determine that the wheelchair was the reason. Maybe they just don't like talkative, you know, New York guys that come in and dominate conversation. So I wouldn't necessarily want to presume that the wheelchair is why I've rubbed them the wrong way, unless they come right out and say, you know, tell me more about what it's like to be in a chair. And then in that case, I'm perfectly happy to address their questions openly, because we only change folks' conceptions if nothing is taboo, right? There's nothing wrong with the fact that I'm in a wheelchair. It just is. And, you know, so there you go.
Mutan Koch is with us, if you've just joined us. He's a prominent disability rights lawyer. He happens also to have, as we've been hearing, cerebral palsy. You, at Yale, you attended Yale University, a president of the student disability community there, and I reading about you, you worked with the office of the president of that university to modernize, to do some things differently, to help students with disabilities. And in a citation in your graduation, the university said, quote, "He did more than anyone in recent memory to raise awareness about disability. He has our admiration and gratitude for making Yale a more inclusive community." I'm wondering at the beginning of that, since you evidently brought so much change to Yale, how much resistance? Can you remember resistance you faced and the type that you faced when you first arrived and saw some things that could really be markedly improved?
Actually, the interesting thing is it was quite the opposite, which is to say I arrived at Yale really focused on some of my other student activities that I was really going to be excited to do, Jewish leadership, other things, and I was really pulled by certain members of the staff to say, we need a student to get involved with disability. And then, so I start, and I almost reluctantly acquiesced to do it because I was the only person positioned to at that time, and I was going to do it for a short period of time. And then I started to notice problems. And then the strangest thing happened. I had begun to make a list of problems. And then we're going to jump back in time for a second. At the very beginning of freshman year, the university had taken a publicity photo of me with the president to showcase the school's diversity, right? It was a simple diversity publication. They wanted to rerun it at the beginning of my sophomore year when I'd taken on the position. I said, no, not unless I can meet with the president to discuss the issues that we're having and what needs to change. What shocked me is not only was he immediately willing to sit down, but he immediately became a truly eager ally for change. Were there individuals that were resistant, faculty set in their ways, people protecting a few fiefdoms? Sure, but one of the things that I'm really grateful for is that from the moment that I reached out in a somewhat forceful fashion, the Yale administration was really a willing partner to make change. They didn't necessarily know how, and we walked that road together, but they were always a willing partner to do it.
Well, list some of the problems that you saw there that you could correct.
Well, the single biggest problem was that centralized, structured handling of disability had broken down, which is to say, way back when the Rehab Act had been passed in 73, this university had established a disability office, but that office was totally divorced by the time I got there from the president's office, from the provost's office, from the dean's office. So whatever they wanted to do with disability, they didn't have the ability to affect. They could persuade, they could cajole, they could talk to people. The single biggest thing we changed was to empower both the students and staff working on disability, say the president supports this, the dean supports this, the provost supports this, we're going to make a change. When there were recalcitrant faculty, we were able to say, sorry, this is university policy, we're going to change. When there were university policies that were simply outdated, it was no longer that we would work with someone in middle management until we found someone who could change the policy. We could go to the president's office and say things like, you know what, you know, this accommodation, I admit 20 years later it's hard to remember specifics, but this accommodation or that accommodation should really be provided by Yale. And rather than having to convince someone in middle management that that was a good idea, we had folks at the top. So I would say if there's one thing we changed, it's that we got everyone together so that we could get the roadblocks out of the way. And then the second thing that we were lucky to do is it happens that early on in my tenure, the disability coordinator who was there when I arrived moved on to pursue other things, and I was able to participate in the hiring of a truly dynamite disability professional who's there to this day. And again, through a combination of fixing the lines of communication, getting her office the power and the prestige and the resources that it need, we really moved change through. By rationalizing the more than $2 million per year that Yale was spending on physical accommodations so that there was a coherent accommodation plan. I mean, sort of the big things that we did just to make it so that Yale was moving forward mm-hmm. in a thoughtful way.
Mm-hmm. Now, after graduating from law school, you spent years in the general counsel's office dealing with legal matters at Procter & Gamble. What disability issues did you face there? What were the challenges that you tackled?
Well, the biggest challenge that we were tackling as a company was how do we make it a better place for employers, for workers with disabilities, and how do we attract more customers with disabilities? And again, one of the things that was great about P&G was that was a huge focus. It was something they wanted to do, but I was privileged to work with them to figure out how to do it. My primary role, to be clear, was as a counsel to the advertising division. I was working on a lot of standard legal issues, but I also served as counsel to and on the disability task force. And again, what we were really working on is how can we make this, a more successful place for employers, and then what would be the next steps to really win the consumer with a disability. And unfortunately, you'll see if you have my resume in front of you, personal circumstances were such that I could only stay there for a couple of years, but I'm pleased to say that P&G continues to work hard on these issues even today.
Now, when you consult with your law firm on issues of disability or advise organizations, what do you find? What is really at the root of the most common misconceptions that you as a disabled person encounter, that others who are disabled encounter when we go try to seek employment, for instance?
Well, I think the two biggest misconceptions are, one, that it's going to be expensive, and two, that it's about dealing with things that folks can't do. So let's dispel the first one right away, and I feel like I have to do this with every client right when I start, right, is that research has been done by the U.S. government that tells us that something like 80% of workplace accommodations are free, and the vast majority of others cost $200 or less. So the notion that people with disabilities are expensive to accommodate is just wrong, but it's a huge barrier that people believe. And the other is that when you're focused on, oh my gosh, how do we deal with a person's needs, it's a very hard discussion. People are often thinking in terms of what they can't do. If instead you can refocus the client to say, okay, we want this person to be the best lawyer that they can be, here's the task that they're struggling to get done, let's figure out a way to access that talent, it suddenly becomes very doable, because the reward is not, gee, we dealt with this problem, it's, gee, we've unlocked this potential. And so I really try to focus the discussion that way, because things suddenly feel so much more doable.
Mm-hmm. You talk about something called purchasing power of the disability community. Is that what you mean?
Well, purchasing power is actually yet another thing. It's the simple fact that the U.S. Census Bureau released a number, and I have the exact number on my website, so if I get it wrong, but I believe they found that the total purchasing power of the disability community in the United States represents about $200 billion a year. So really what I was saying is that they should be being marketed to just like any other subgroup, because they have an incredible amount of discretionary spend.
Mm.
And so it's nothing more than to say that, you know,
I see.
I worked at the country's biggest consumer products manufacturer for a while. We segment by consumer group, and people should know that there's huge purchasing power for the disability world.
Are there companies or entities out there that are recognizing this better than others?
Well, I think Walgreens earned an early reputation for getting out ahead of the curve. I think that others are beginning to follow. I know that P&G is having the discussion internally. I think that, you know, I think there's a lot of internal discussion, but I'd love to see more of it expressed in the way people are externally developing, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. You spent almost 3 years, I understand, on the National Council on Disability. Politically, what are the major challenges you face as a member of that council?
Well, I think one of the biggest challenges is that everybody wants to do the right thing, but A, we're a little bit divided on what the right thing is, and B, this isn't going to come to surprise to anyone who follows the political world, we're in a massive financial crunch. So while disability isn't expensive, disability budgets often look like places that are ripe for cutting, and I got to tell you, it's really hard to talk about doing new and exciting things when you're also looking at 10 and 15 and 20% budget cuts. And I think that the secondary part is that in large part, the government is one place where we could use to see more money spent on disabilities. Obviously, the government provides the safety net. The government is, you know, for many people with disabilities, a source of things that they can't get in the private sector. So a huge challenge that I often feel is it often feels like we were simply fighting a bit of a delaying action. On the one hand, we want to move forward with positive things. On the other hand, we're just trying to protect the important benefits that people with disabilities have, which is why, you know, even small victories like the ABLE Act that recently passed are just wonderful to have because they're steps forward, right? And I think that in this environment, any step forward is something to be celebrated.
We only have a couple minutes left, but tell us, what are the most hotly disputed cases or questions in the area of disability rights at the moment?
Well, I think the single biggest issue that has captured the headlines is the CRPD, the Convention on Rights for Persons with Disabilities, which is largely modeled after the ADA, but we're one of the only countries in the world yet to ratify. I feel like that's not only is that one of the biggest hot-button political issues in the disability community right now, I think it's one, you know, I seldom take strong positions in public fora, but I will say if there's one thing we might ought be a little ashamed of as a body politic, it's that we can't ratify an international statement of the same ideals that we've codified into law in this country. And but in terms of the biggest hot-button issue, and this ties so well into, I think, what your previous segment was on, although I wasn't privileged to listen, it's really jobs, jobs, jobs. We're all focused on the fact that even as employment bounces back for people without disabilities, the disability employment level remains abysmally low, and it's really a question of what can we do politically, what can we do practically to move that along, and it's an endless subject of discussion.
Okay, well, let's skip a few of the minutiae and jump into the future in this last minute. How do you think, how do you hope future generations will look back at our time, considering the change you and others hope to bring about? Look back at our time in terms of how we view disabilities, attitudes towards disabilities.
I hope that we look back, and it seems anachronistic that we ever talked in terms of disability. I hope that we look back and or future generations look back and recognize the twist where we started taking each person as an individual customer and celebrating their strengths, where we really did have a universal inclusion that makes the label of disability seem as outdated as, you know, the class system of a previous century.
Mm. I was surprised a few years ago on this program interviewing a young man who had been born without any legs and asking him about this topic, and he didn't consider himself disabled. He considered society disabled for the way that it looked at him.
That's a common perception, and you know, I think that if we can get society to a place where conditions are not disabling, that is indeed the change that I would love to see.
And what are the levers? How does this change happen?
I really think it actually happens one by one on individual attitudes. I mean, the reason I've launched a national speaking tour and I'm actually taking time to go around and talk about it is I really think you need to change individual hearts one at a time, and each person changes the way we deal with each other. I don't think you can legislate this. I don't think it can be a policy initiative. I think it really needs to be a sea change in our behavior.
That was Ben Kiefer's interview with Matan Koch from March of last year. Koch is a disability rights attorney who advocates for more employers to hire and find the strength in disabled employees. Tomorrow on the show, it's Politics Day. Donna Hoffman of UNI will join the show to talk about the results of the Super Tuesday primary election. Make sure to tune in for that discussion tomorrow on River to River at noon on Iowa Public Radio. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from John Pemble and Dennis Reese. Podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River are available at iowapublicradio.org. We always welcome your questions and comments about the show. Contact us anytime at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Emily Woodbury. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.